Welcome to episode 13 of Indie Movie Cast, the podcast for indie movie makers by indie movie makers. I'm Alex.
I'm Jay.
I'm Dominic.
And I'm Dennis.
Yeah, Dennis
What's
is
up,
back.
Dennis?
What's Hi, up, Dennis? Guys?
It's good to be back.
It's good to have laughter finally back on the show again.
Yeah.
I didn't even laugh yet.
I think I laugh more than I talk.
Yeah, it's good to have nice, the beautiful sound of children laughing.
It gives us confidence because it makes us think we're funny.
Anything I can do to help, guy.
You're the man.
Okay, guys. Well, thank you for joining me. This is Indie Movie Cast. We talk about indie movie making. We are all part of Ultimatum Pictures. We are a movie making team here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And we have a pretty exciting week ahead of us. We are doing our first big premiere.
Oh, yeah, we are.
Yeah, this coming Friday.
Friday,
we're premiering our movie Voiceover, which is a movie that we shot last spring. And it's a longer short for us. It's a half hour. We didn't do it for any competition. We just did it to put it out there, make a longer movie. And we're pretty happy with it. It kind of seems like a long time ago. Then we made like 1,000 movies since we made Voiceover, but
it's been a long time coming. This premiere, you know, where we're finally gonna get everybody hopefully into the same room to watch it. Gonna try to get all the actors, all the cast. All the crew and families. It should be fun. I hope we could get as many people who worked on this project as possible to check it out finally.
Yeah, and we're having the premiere in a theater. It's not just like in my living room, like our usual premiere.
Yeah.
There's a little theater here in Albuquerque called The Cell, which is an awesome little theater. They usually do live shows, but they occasionally show movies. And yeah, so we check them out. They're hooking us up big time because our star, Bruce Holmes of Voiceover, works there. So we're getting a pretty good deal there. So we're just so excited. I'm so excited.
I'm excited. This should be really fun.
Yeah, we're gonna pretend we're big shots that night for sure.
We're gonna wear tuxedos and we're gonna do a lot of drugs.
Well,
drink.
I was just
crazy
gonna show
amounts of alcohol. And Dennis will show up in sweats.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't
but that is dressing up for you, like, though.
Yeah,
it kind of is.
Yeah. But so we're really excited about that, and I'm happy you're here, Dennis. Dennis worked hard on Voiceover.
Yep.
Everybody did, man. It was a good effort by everyone. Yeah,
it's a good effort. It's a great movie, and we're excited to show everybody.
And this was a tricky one to shoot. If we could talk about just briefly, because we shot a half hour movie basically in 3 days.
Yeah,
and took a year to edit it.
And took us
I'm
this
just
long.
Kidding.
No, it did. It took us a long time to get the editing just right and to get the music. And
well, it was 4 days if you include the reshoot day.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
We did reshoot some of the scenes for one day. Yeah, so this movie's a long time coming. We shot this before Cannibless, if you follow our roster.
Yeah, we did 3 movies after this.
Yeah, we shot this movie after Super Atomic Comedies before Cannibalist. So it's weird because we've gone a long way since Voiceover, but we haven't finished Voiceover yet. But I still love it. I think it's hilarious. And
well, that's the thing. It's like, oh, you work on it so long. I mean, we've put a lot of time and energy, and you're like, is this movie even good? I don't know. But
we've seen it so many times.
Early reviews or some people who have seen it, they go, oh, this is really good. It's hysterical. And so that again, that keeps you motivated.
They go, it's hysterical.
Ourselves last week.
We're
going
to have a theater of hysterics.
Yeah, you're going to be in hysterics watching Voiceover. So, and if you're in the Albuquerque area, we're doing an encore showing at 6:30 this Saturday at The Cell. And that's an invitation to anybody. So, yeah, please come check it out if you want to see our movie Voiceover as well as our other shorts. We're doing a full Ultimatum screening. And it's just the biggest night of our lives, so give a little flack. We're so excited. It's gonna be so fun.
Huge.
so hopefully we'll gain some new listeners here on the podcast too. But let's get into the podcast. Let's talk about indie movie making. There's an article that filmmaker.com put out, you know, years ago, and I've wanted to talk about it for a long time.
This is a years old, this article?
Yeah, they wrote it, and it's from April 2007, but it still relates today. Definitely, but it's called The Dumps.
And it looks like they update it too, so.
Yeah, they do. So it's called The Dumps. The Dump stands for Directing Unsuccessful Motion Picture Shorts. Mm-hmm. So this is how to make an unsuccessful short movie. And let me just read what they say. On a whole, student short films suck. Dump contains not the usual advice you get in film school about the elements of good screenwriting. No, no. Rather, it's a very specific list of common mistakes and trends which we've seen in crappy student films again and again at screening after screening. Before you even think about making a student film, read this list. If you're a genius, then go ahead, break these rules. But let's face it, if you think you're a genius, you're not. So play it safe and spare your audience the uneasy task of having to lie when you ask, so what did you think? So let the list of sucking begin. So this is common things that indie filmmakers do, especially when they're way indie, like we are. So this is a list of stuff that, you know, you really shouldn't do. And I'll admit, we are guilty of some of these things.
Oh, we are guilty.
I mean, this list is kind of new to us. So this is,
yeah, we are guilty.
So the first one is the dolly zoom, the dolly slash zoom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so this is that zoom where you zoom in on someone or where you bring the camera forward as you zoom out. It's this Vertigo Hitchcock thing. You know,
okay.
So it says, sure, Hitchcock used it in Vertigo, Spielberg used it in Jaws, but enough is enough. It's cliched, overused, goofy, and an overall bad idea. And we've never done this, but I've always kind of wanted to, but now I never will.
Well, we did it in Super Atomic Commies.
Yeah, exactly.
Super Atomic Commies. Ah!
Yeah, we did.
And by the way, that's the one that won, so what is this
and
list?
I did it in Fright, too, so.
Honestly, it's okay if it's motivated, but yeah, it's cliche, but if it's motivated.
Well, I think with anything on this list, I mean, I get that this guy's in the DGA or whatever, but still, it's like, if it's motivated, there could be a good place for it.
To defend Super Atomic Commies, though, that is supposed to be a parody on 1950s, hokey-pokey B-movie stuff, so.
True. I think Super Atomic Commies gets away with everything because they get cheesy on purpose. But, but yeah, I think, you know, you're right, Dominic, but all this guy is pointing out is this stuff is overused. And
it's overused in student films.
So anyway, so dolly zoom, avoid it.
I don't know. How else are you supposed to learn, man? It's like, you got to try it out.
Yeah, you got to try it out.
Got to get out of your system.
But I guess it's a saying, everybody tries it out. And so, you know, it's not necessary to pretty much any story, but it's just a trick, the dolly zoom. But okay, moving on.
Next one, we're going to shoot the entire thing with a dolly zoom.
That would be amazing, actually.
We'll make dolly zoom the movie.
Exactly.
That would be amazing.
call it DZ.
Yeah.
One of our listeners out there is going to steal this idea. I know it. If you do, send us the link to the movie.
Oh, please make that movie. I'm sure it would make everybody dizzy. Like,
it'd be like a, you know, a Michael Bay movie or something.
I can't wait.
Okay. All right, so the tortured artist film is their next one.
Oh, yeah.
The story goes like this. A struggling artist, writer, painter, sculptor, musician, 90% of the time it's a writer, grapples with some sort of inner conflict, dead relative, writer's deadline, religious confusion, etc. Our tormented soul encounters a muse, beautiful woman, or whatever, a fairy.
Totally changes everything. Yeah.
Who helps the protagonist come to some sort of realization. And we've never really done this, but I admit I have seen a lot of movies with this kind of structure.
What are you talking about? Anna Bless, our character was an artist, his whole thing. You know what to do, art.
That's true, dude. Boom.
Oh man, that's our tortured artist. He wasn't a tortured.
There you go.
He wasn't tortured though.
He was just a stoner kid in cannabis.
Maybe he was tortured, and that's why he was smoking so much.
There you go.
So anyways, if you want to see this entire list, just watch our movies, right? No, I mean
voiceover. He's not an artist per se, but he's tortured.
No, I know. I'm just messing.
he's a tortured salesman.
But the reason why I think because the torture artist and why you shouldn't do it is because, you know, it's kind of an easy way, you know, people could identify with it. And I think a lot of people go so super serial with this kind of subject matter. It's so easy to become really sappy and.
Well, it's kind of a lazy because when you write about a tortured writer, you're kind of writing about yourself trying to write this movie.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, what am I gonna write? Oh, I'll write about a writer who can't come up with
becomes
something.
Adaptation.
And none of us are. Yeah, none of us are Charlie Kaufman. So.
Right.
Yeah. But it's even. Yeah. It's just a kind of a no-no. Yeah. Nobody wants to see your story, man.
Tortured.
You have to tell other people's stories. That's why you're a writer.
Unless
Dominic,
you're Charlie
you
Kaufman.
Have a script that we've talked about, which I really love, about like a tortured musician.
Don't say the whole thing.
Oh, come on. I just said music. I mean, it's the same concept.
It's going to steal our ideas, dude. All right, let's go on. Okay, so next dump is dream sequences. You know, if you don't want your student film to look like a friggin' episode of Kung Fu, stay away from dream sequences, Grasshopper. A dream sequence generally says, I couldn't think of a better way to reveal information about this character than this. So-called funny dream sequences are usually not. Yeah, I can't say we've ever done a dream sequence.
Oh, hold on. Dennis will prove us wrong, or Dominic will.
I'm thinking, now you put me on the spot, and now I'm drawing a blank.
We definitely have. The last
dream sequence.
Yeah, the last we made a movie way back when we did our public access show.
Yeah.
You know, earlier in the decade, we made a movie where I'm in it, and I just keep waking up over and over and from various dream sequences, but that's again was a parody of dream sequencing. But we've never done it. Yeah, I can't think. I don't even remember my dreams these days, so I couldn't even write a dream sequence if I wanted to.
It is kind of a lazy way to reveal information. I mean,
yeah. My dreams these days are going to work. I'm like at work looking, scouting for.
Because I don't even like it when big movies do it when it's a dream sequence, and because usually sometimes they're a little bit more boring. Rest of the movie. Oh my god, I sit through this dream sequence.
Yeah, I'd rather than break out into musical sequences like in 500 Days of Summer than a dream sequence. Yeah. Okay.
I agree with that.
Okay, no dream sequences. You heard it on dumps. Okay. Next is the time elapse montage.
Oh, right.
You've got, say, 15 minutes to get a point across in a short film. Every second of the screen should be treated like gold. A time-elapse montage not only demonstrates an inability to structure your film pacing-wise, but it makes the audience wait unnecessarily. Try to find a simple and efficient way to indicate the passing of time without resorting to this too-easy narrative device. So, Dennis, which movies do we use a time-elapse montage that we've made?
Well, VoiceOver, we have a montage.
Yeah, VoiceOver's like...
But if we want to defend that, it's kind of different because he's just collecting up clients and...
Well, it's all about his head. See, that's what I have a problem with this guy saying about montages. Like,
well, yeah, I guess he's talking about just stay away from them in general. I mean, they're kind of unnecessary, I guess.
Well, I mean, when I think of like the montage sequence, like if you're gonna create the passing of time, it's a guy, looking in the mirror, brushing his teeth, then getting a bowl of cereal, and then that's kind of montage-y, or no?
I know what you mean. It seems like there's a lot of movies where the person like shows him brushing his teeth and stuff.
Yeah,
I don't know. Anyway, I think he's just saying montages are overused, and they might be. I mean, we don't use them often. We like we said, VoiceOver has one, but it's kind of different because it kind of leads into everything.
Yeah,
but
so how would we remedy this? Like, how would you do some passing of time? Because I always notice that, like Breaking Bad or something like, or TV shows or something like that, they'll go out and record like the sun setting for an hour.
I hate that.
They'll just super fast forward it, so you see all the clouds going all quick, and it's like, okay, now it's night.
Yeah, I don't know. Or that's kind of cheesy, like shooting.
That is cheesy.
Shooting someone deliver a paper is cheesy. I mean, it's stuff that indicates the next day. That's what that is. It's when they wanted to say it's the next day, but there's no real way to distinguish that other than doing.
Well, I think Breaking Bad does it so you can look at the pretty landscapes and stuff and get a New Mexico atmosphere. But I don't know. When I see time elapse montage, I think of just where they're trying to tell a story, but fast, like they just really do a time lapse thing where it just like speeds through it and you see a bunch of like clips of them getting ready and like you just have to wait there for it to end and you're like, ugh.
But maybe this guy's not talking about TV though. maybe he's just talking about short films. Like, in your short film, you have a short amount of time. Why put a montage in? You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You instead just want to come in with
get to your
ready.
Damn story.
Yeah. So
I just got ready. Let's go.
Yeah. So I don't think it's talking about Breaking Bad. I think it's talking about us. So. But yeah. So all right. Well, we'll avoid him.
I agree with it too. You don't. You should need it in a short.
All right. So the next one on the dumps list is bad audio, and this is a guys.
We've already talked about this, but yeah, go on.
Yeah, it says you can have a nice-looking short film, but if the sound is bad, the film itself comes out as bad. Nothing gives away a student film like the soundtrack. Budgets are tight, sure, but many student directors simply don't place any importance and give any thought to what their film sounds like. Mm-hmm. The result is often a beautiful picture with badly mixed, distracting audio experience. In the same vein, if you're making a 16mm film, be aware about how crappy the 16mm optical track is going to sound, which is really bad, and try to prepare for it. And then they go, and now free of charge, a canonical list of the bad musical soundtrack instruments. So this is for the soundtrack. So these are no-nos because it's hard to get original music. It is. You know, we have Brian, thank God.
Yeah, we've lucked out.
Yeah, but so these are things you shouldn't do. One, the synthesizer, the porn soundtrack. You know, because those are really easy to make on your own. Two, your friend's band. Trust me, they suck. Three, the lone slow piano. Like, da, 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 da. Yeah, I've heard that. Four, the lone guitar. Flamenco especially. Yeah, we saw a whole horror movie with nothing but one guitar player, and it kind of made me cry.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah. Number five, the impish clarinet.
Nice.
Six.
I've never really heard that. I don't know if I...
I don't know. I just think of Peter and the Wolf.
Okay.
number six, the cello dirge. I guess the cello. Seven, piccolo and eight, any kind of wood blocks. I guess what it's saying is don't just have somebody with, you know, I guess
instrument playing for it, right?
Like we know a girl who plays violin, but I'm not going to ask her to do a whole soundtrack and just violin because she's somebody who knows how to play it.
Well, and she's also, I mean, Brian's actually worked with her, you know, on a short film that we made years ago called Discrepancies. That was the first movie, but he like mixed his own music with the vibe. Exactly. So there was a compilation going on. So,
yeah, Brian makes mixes. He does it all himself. He sings, he plays guitar, he plays drums, whatever he has to do. But it's a full song.
Right.
You know, and it's a big difference than him just sitting there with his guitar, you know, and as he goes. Yeah. So. Yeah. It's big, and as far as bad sound, yeah, that's a big one, guys.
Sound drives me nuts. I mean, I'm kind of like picky when it comes to sound. I want great sound. It's just, but sometimes we just don't have a sound guy right now. Like we've talked about this, and it's just so frustrating trying to get really good sound.
And I think voiceover
it's frustrating.
And voiceover in Heaven and Cannibless have points where there's obviously sound issues, and
yeah.
You know, and those make our really good looking movies look a little worse. So it's something we're struggling with, but it's something we are aware of and we are trying.
Yeah,
as hard as
definitely
we can.
Trying.
Yeah,
people
so
will definitely put up with a bad picture, but they will not stand bad audio.
Well, that's what we were talking about. We were talking about if you have horrible picture but beautiful sound, it looks like it's supposed to be that way. Whereas if you have beautiful picture but bad sound, it's like this is a piece of junk.
This is horrible.
We luckily have Brian, but what if we didn't? I mean, a lot of independent filmmakers don't have access to people that play instruments and stuff. So what do we suggest they do?
I used to make my own. I know it says not to do it, but
well,
you know, I mean, what else are you going to do? You know?
I'll tell you what though. If you are a little bit more outgoing and stuff, you can go to like the universities, you know, in your town, and you can, you know, find like a lot of young students want to compose music for films, or that's what they're interested in, or this and that. And you can find people at universities too.
Yeah, or look up local bands. But you're right, Dominic.
Yeah.
If you don't know anybody, I think the way to go is Soundtrack, the Apple program. I
mean, that's a little cheesy though too.
It's a little cheesy, but you can get it to sound elite. If it's just background music, you can put it in there so it doesn't sound weird.
It depends how creative you are.
Yeah, I mean that's something you can play with and you can make something on your own.
I will say there are some certain sounds on Soundtrack that you even hear in national commercials and stuff. Like, totally. You're just all, yeah. They got that loop.
Well, I'll tell you what, like, when we go to, like, the 48-hour, you know, festivals where we're watching everybody's movie, I'm like, boom, they got that music and soundtrack. I can instantly recognize what they've taken from soundtrack. Yeah. So, to me, that's why...
Spirited Bells won.
Yeah, well, I guess my point is, if you have nothing, that's better than getting your friend to play a strum on a guitar for 10 minutes. But,
but if your friend is good, they could only get better.
Yeah, and I don't think there's anything wrong with looking to a local band to help you out. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all. I mean, I understand he's saying, like, they probably suck, but...
No, he's not saying band. He's saying your friend's band. He's saying your... And I think this is what he's saying, is people just get their friends to help them out, you know, whether their friends are talented or not. It's like, oh, Bill plays piccolo.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's what it's saying. Your friend's band, not the local band. If you go and find a really good band, I think that's smart. Go find that band and seek them out. And, you know, or if your band's really, or if your friend's band is really good. I mean, Brian's just really good. It's just coincidence that he's a friend of ours. We got lucky.
Yeah.
Okay, the next one is called Look at Me, I'm a Director Shots. You know, the gratuitous examples include the gratuitous fishbowl in the back foreground shot, the overhead for no reason except we're shooting on a soundstage shot, the we think it's cool kit to do a Dutch angle shot, and perhaps the most insidious, the fridge point of view shot, otherwise known as put the camera inside the trash can toilet mailbox shot. Okay, you need to get this stuff out of your system, but be warned, it's total cheese. So, you know.
We've done it. We've all done them.
We've done it.
Enough said.
Date Doctor has a fridge shot.
Date Doctor has a fishbowl shot.
we have an overhead shot in Proxy, even though it's not Proxy. We're not on a stage, but we do.
Oh, and also in a voiceover.
I like overhead shots. Sorry.
No, I like them too. And it's not saying that they're
bad. And I like Dutch angles too.
Yeah.
I'm not a big Dutch fan, honestly.
It's just saying that it's cheesy. If it's done right, it's done right. But you know what it's saying.
It's blatantly obvious, that's where you're getting the problem.
It's saying try to be more creative. I think is what this is saying. You know, it's like Dutch angle might look cool sometimes, but everybody does it. Try maybe get something else. You know,
that's what like a straight gunshot. Is that overworked?
I mean that's just like. I agree, Dom.
I mean, it's just like, I get why he's being nitpicky, and you could totally tell when somebody's doing it, when they're trying to do it to be look creative, and they're not. That's what he's probably saying.
Yeah, still. They're doing it purposefully, and you can, there's just that, you can just tell watching it, like, oh, they did this Dutch angle just because they thought it was.
Well, you know, the fridge thing, like, the fridge thing, it's not that it's not kind of interesting. It's not that it doesn't look cool. It's just that it's overdone. That's all it's saying. Yeah. Everybody does it. It's, you know, think of some another creative way.
And I agree. Get it out of your system.
Yeah.
But I don't feel the same way about a fridge shot like I do a Dutch angle shot. Like there's a difference between just doing a Dutch angle shot or incorporating them stylistically. I think
it's all about stylistically and creatively.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. All right. Okay, next one is ultra slow dialogue. A film professor once told me that on a film set, this 1 second of real time equals 3 seconds of film time. Something to remember. Watch a student film and notice how often there are long pauses between lines of dialogue. I would agree with that. Avoid that. Yeah. Let's move on. Blatant miscasting. The audience can tell when you cast your significant other as a romantic object of desire. Yeah. Two, don't try to pass someone off as who is fugly as a supermodel.
That should be number one.
Three, in the same vein, why do so many student films cast SAG boy wonders as the computer nerd who can't get a date? Four, mismatched couples, be honest. Do you believe that she would go out with him? Make sure the answer is yes. Five, don't have your friends play older characters. Yep. The baby.
Let's just talk about this.
That's number one. That should
Let's
be
talk
one.
About this for a second. Because this is the biggest problem that all student films have.
Well, it's true. It's like, and like the 48-hour film challenge has like a detective cop.
It's 20-year-olds playing 40-year-olds.
Yeah, and it never fails that they have like an 18-year-old playing an old detective.
Yeah, unless they did something like Brick, where that would be kind of cool.
That's
that was
totally
kinda...
different, though. That's not yeah. even on
that's being creative
discussing
with
here. That's nothing what we're discussing here. No, it's true. It's true. You have to cast appropriately. You have to. Otherwise, you just don't buy it. You don't buy it.
Yeah, there's. I guarantee there's older actors in your town who are dying. Yeah. To have a part, so cast old people.
And I try to go out of my way as best I can to find older actors. I know we know so many young actors, and everybody's like, and it would be great to cast all your young actor friends and buddies, but like at the end of the day, it's like, well, I'm trying to be a little bit serious about this, and I'm sorry, but I gotta get, I want some older people, and it's just because they when you have people who look like what they're supposed to be, it gravitates, it puts weight into your project. It gives it more, it makes it more authentic, et cetera.
Yeah. And the other things he mentioned too about miscasting, casting good looking people as nerds.
Yeah.
Pairing people together as couples, you know,
yeah.
It's like,
and I've seen student movies where the girl is supposed to be this hot object of desire. And I'm just like, I'm sorry. She is not hot. Like, she's fugly, what they said, you know? It's just like, I don't buy this for a second.
Yeah.
And that's mean, I know, but that's the way I feel.
Well, I mean, it's true. So that's another big one. Look at your parts. You know, go try to make the character the best character it can be, and that includes when you're casting it. And yeah, don't cast your girlfriend, please. You know, you can...
Unless she's an actress and she's good.
Yeah.
But if they've never, you know, sat, you know, in front of a camera once in their lives, of course, come on, you know.
Yeah, but even if she's good, people put their girlfriend in every movie they make.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And I think
like Tim Burton with Helen Bonham.
Yeah, but I mean locally too. People, you know, it's like these people have the same girl in every movie because it's the director's girl, and it's obvious.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's move on. It says eyebrow acting. They call eyebrow acting just overused facial expressions. I would agree, avoid that. But that just goes back to finding good actors. You know, find real actors, people.
If they're trained properly, they know the difference between theater and film. And,
yeah. On theater, they have to use their face a lot. In film, they're right in their face. So, okay. So the next one is the Nothing Happens short film. A very common bad student film. Usually consists of a main character who spends his or her time talking to people about nothing of consequence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Nothing happens to 45 minutes. At the end, some contrived climax comes out of nowhere and tries to wrap everything up. But because there has been no conflict of any sort for so long, the audience is asleep and misses it. Common threads include films that include the, quote, personal discovery epiphanies that go inside the main character's head film. The warm... Yeah, we've never done that. We've never looked at any of that. But our voiceover is good. it's not really like that. There's no conflict in voiceover like that. It's more of a self-esteem. I don't know. Yeah.
That struck a nerve with Alex.
Yeah. Oh, wait till I mean
defensive mode.
Yeah, we're not done. We're not done. Giving all the cliched examples. Voice.
And I love how we're doing this on the premiere day. I love it.
I know.
Okay, this Nothing Happens short film. They say 50% of these films include an alcoholic single parent. So they're just talking about these movies where nothing happens for them.
There's no story. No.
Like the
motivation.
No. Yeah, I see a lot of movies where like they follow some guy just walking around a city and.
Yeah,
and, you know, and talking to people, and nothing happens, and they go home and they kill themselves or something. You know.
Yeah, we've all seen these. Yeah, they're dry. But a story.
So, yeah, make a real story. Exactly. Beginning, middle, and end. Beginning, middle, and end. Remember that. That's how people's minds.
And voiceover, has that.
Definitely does.
Okay. It has a beginning, middle, and end, and it has a story. Promise you.
Okay, so So the next one is the feature film masquerading as a short film. And what they mean is really, really long short films, I think. So
is that what this says?
Yeah, so if you ever sat through a screening of student films, you'll notice that often the ones that are the best received are the shorter films.
Yeah.
Now, it could be argued this is due to the simple fact that they suck and less sucking is better than more sucking. Or it could be because the audience is sitting through many, many student films in one evening and appreciates the shorter ones because it means the whole thing will end sooner. I mean that sounds a little harsh, but it's true. When you're sitting through the, you know, these 48-hour film things and stuff, you get to a point where you want to rip your head off sometimes, especially if the movie's bad. But you know,
5 minutes is a long time.
Yeah, you know, and I guess we're gonna put our audience to the test when we show all our shorts this weekend.
Yeah,
but
we're gonna test their patience.
Man, this podcast is hilarious. And then anyway, it says, ask yourself when writing and editing the film, is that scene truly necessary? Is this moment necessary? And I want to say we are good at that. We are very good at editing ourselves and cutting stuff out that's unnecessary, I think. And
I hope so.
VoiceOver went through a pretty big edit, and yep. I think that it flows really well. So there, we're good at that. Meh.
Yeah. Next.
Okay, next is the one joke film. Basically, it's just like one joke and you put a whole movie around it.
Okay, yeah.
Next is the walk into camera transition.
Oh, yeah.
This one is zany. A character walks into the camera lens and then we fade to black, or more commonly cut to the reverse of someone walking away from the camera lens.
Yeah.
Ooh, what a good idea. That's what the article says.
I don't think we've done that one.
Not really.
Thankfully, we haven't stumbled into that one.
That one doesn't bother me too much, I'd say.
Well, again,
but I know it is cliche.
Saying it's done a lot.
Yeah, totally.
All right, next is the zany quote "slacker with a gun" film.
That's like 50% of your movies.
The article says you are not Quentin Tarantino. Stop trying.
Boom. Yeah. No, I am guilty on all charges. I put guns in my movies and have
guns
people
rock.
Running around shooting each other, and I'll still do it because I like it.
Guns are awesome, man.
Well, luckily for you, I'm writing your movies these days, so.
I'll still shoot them off.
Yeah. So enough of the you know, teenage gangster films. But going back again to what we said about young people, there's a lot of young people criminals with guns movies out there.
Yep.
Okay, so other things, overused video effects, keep dissolves to a minimum. Yeah,
totally. I hate
Amen.
Dissolves.
The 80s are over. Yes.
There's that old editing trick: if you can't solve it, dissolve it.
Yep.
that's just lazy editing, but yeah.
That's a terrible,
I like
hate
that.
Dissolves. You notice that I never really do dissolves in our movies except when I absolutely have to. Like the proxy, there's one dissolve.
But it's only an effect thing too. I mean,
yeah.
I would never. I don't like them.
It goes back into if it fits, but it's overused.
Yeah.
So try not to use it. Okay, this next one I love, the dramatic cigarette. A character is having a dramatic crisis, but what does he or she do? Whips out a smoke and puffs it dramatically, as if to say, "Look, this is so serious. I'm smoking." Yes, people do smoke when they're nervous or excited or under pressure, but there's no excuse for using the long, boring dragon puff scene as a lazy alternative to finding a more original way to express the same thing.
Dude, this is exactly why
purloin
I
purloin package. Hate. Purloin package for
oh,
me.
Purloin.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
What were you
dumbest
saying, Dennis?
I just hated Constantine for that very reason so much.
Oh, the movie Constantine.
Not only that,
yeah.
if you're gonna put a smoker in your movie, make sure he knows how to smoke.
Yeah.
Keanu Reeves looks so fake, like he was trying to smoke in that movie. With the long drawn out, just drag. Ugh, it's anger.
Like our actor, our main actor in Heaven, he smoked at the beginning, but boom, you knew he's like, it looked like he smoked, and it wasn't.
Well, that he didn't do a dramatic scene like.
Yeah, he didn't do it dramatically.
He's just smoking because he's in Heaven.
Yeah.
All right. Next is the quest for truth. And he goes, and the article says, there are several permutations for this theme. What, number one, the puzzled scientist. The story deals with a puzzled, reclusive scientist who learns to forego cold, hard science for something warm, gushy, intangible, like love, God, morality, religion, or free will. Films in this genre usually are condescending to the audience and set up a bogus sounding explanations for scientific principles. Number two, it's not.
Free will, baby, at the end there.
It is nice. Number two, the venting film. Broke up with your boy / girlfriend? Please don't make a movie about it. It's dangerous. These self-examinatory why my ex dumped me films turn into long diatribes about the nature of love, the nature of mankind. Yeah, cheesy, boring stuff. Yeah, I agree. Don't make a movie about breaking up with your girlfriend.
Love sucks.
Yeah. Everybody has enough of their own problems. They don't need your despair. You know, that's why romantic comedies are so popular, because people like to see happy love stories because their lives are so miserable. Keep that in mind.
Yeah.
When you're sad and writing. But next is Shooting Into Mirrors. He goes, yep. Now don't get me wrong, shooting into a mirror can be used to great effect when used in the right time for the right reasons. But like so many narrative devices abused by student filmmakers, the reflective shot has become a staple of a bad short film. Cool. So she puts her hand mirror right there, and we could see her boyfriend yelling behind her, and it's all in one shot. Man, I'm a genius. So, and again, it's saying that it's cool sometimes, but it gets over.
It's just got to be used properly.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Simple as that. Simple as that.
Yeah, I mean, it's cool that there's a mirror in the room and there's two actors and you can line it up, but, you know, don't make that the whole point of the scene.
It's okay, like a one-joke movie.
So next is the interminable credit sequence.
Oh, God.
Know you're excited about your film and you have a lot of people to thank, but please consider the poor audience member who has to sit through 10 films. Yeah, we've seen credit sequences run longer than the film itself. Here are some things to think about. Scroll fast, real fast. 2, small fonts are great. 3, okay, well, yeah, title cards are fast, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's just saying don't do long.
Yeah, I agree.
And it says, must you thank your entire family tree by name? And I'm kind of neurotic about this, too. I hate it when, you know, when you do a short film, it's kind of a team effort. And I hate it when people say, okay, director and prop master and you know, driver.
Well, when it comes up, when it's like directed by so-and-so, then that director's name leaves. And then it comes up produced by, and it's the same name as the director, and then that leaves.
Yeah.
And it's like written by, and it's exactly the same GD name. And then it keeps going on and on. You know,
I kind of insist on
one title card for, like, just say the direct, like, I don't have a problem saying directed and edited by so-and-so. Like, it's on once, and then that name is gone forever, you know?
Yeah. Yep. But you know, editing's a big job.
Concise.
But when you say, I did props and I did craft service, it's like, you know what?
Yeah.
No one really cares who went and picked up the pizza, okay? You're not craft service, you know?
And 99% of the public don't know what the hell craft service is either.
Yeah. So keep your credits short. Nobody cares who did every detail. You don't have to credit everybody for every little job they did. Give them one title, you know. I'll send my crew out to do little favors and stuff, you know, but just because they went and picked up a pair of shoes, they're not costumes,
if
the job was lighting, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You're not gonna be lighting in costumes, I'm sorry. And so so just credit your people once or twice if you have to, and keep it short.
But if you credit them twice, you know, put them on the same screen, I say, you know. This and this, same time, and then get on with it.
And another thing I would recommend is make your credits interesting. You know, we try to. Jay usually does a really good job at that.
Not in the cliche way where it goes backwards just because he saw 7.
true that.
Okay, see a lot of shorts that go, the credits go backwards, though.
Okay, and the last one, of the dumps list on filmmaker.com, just stabs me in the heart, and it's
sure does.
It's scene 1. The protagonist wakes up. There is nothing inherently wrong with starting a film with the buzz of an alarm clock, a hand slapping the snooze button, eyes fluttering open, followed by a yawn or a "Oh my God, I'm late." But why so much of this? We see it all the time, as if the writer-director woke up in the morning, looked around, and said, wow, this is cool, but better go back to sleep.
Not a shot-for-shot voiceover.
Voiceover.
Like, yeah, down to the T.
All right, let me explain this real quick. Voiceover is about a day in the life of this guy, and he has really low self-esteem, so it shows the inside of his head through his whole day, telling him that he's a really terrible person. And then the movie's kind of about how he gains his self-esteem back and gets that voice in his head to turn into a nicer person. I mean,
shut up for a minute.
Yeah, so it starts out with the alarm clock going up and the voice in his head saying, wake up, you idiot, you're late. And then our character wakes up.
And then the character wakes up and slaps the alarm clock with his hand.
Yeah, so our movie starts off exactly.
Do we have a montage sequence of him getting ready?
Hey! We're not talking about that.
And the dolly zoom on his briefcase.
There is no dolly zoom.
And we do high angle shots of him walking around the house.
There's like some pops and bad audio there. And
yeah.
Okay. And then I put the camera in the mailbox.
No, you didn't. Okay, you didn't.
I know, I didn't.
Okay, and then he lights his cigarette as he's walking around.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think the point of this list is not that these things are bad, that this doesn't make your movie bad, guys. This does not make anything that's necessarily bad. It's just stuff to avoid because it's overdone.
Yeah.
I mean, yep. I would say besides the audio thing and, you know, the stuff like that. But the little techniques, you're still allowed to do anything you want. This is your movie. But just be aware that other people are using alarm clock shots to open their movies.
Yeah, and you might get a sigh because they're like, oh, great. I've seen this a million times.
I would really hate this kind of distresses me because I would really hate for somebody to turn on voiceover and see an alarm clock and turn it off right away because the movie is really original. I mean, the main thing people say is that the movie is a great idea and that it's very original. And so I would hope that the little cliches that we didn't know we should have avoided shouldn't be in there, but I don't know.
Everybody makes mistakes. They're not even mistakes, but, you know.
Yeah, just be aware of what's cliche, I guess. You know, there's a lot of people like us. There's a lot of people making movies out there, so to stand out, avoid these things.
I think there's a lot of good points, but I think, you know, with it being indie, and if you're really not familiar with a lot of stuff, try it out. It's the only way you're going to get better is just to do everything in the book, not just something. So, I don't know. I'm a fan of at least trying it out. If it doesn't work and if your script calls for it,
you're just
not
mad about the Dutch angle thing.
Well, and I like dolly zooms too. I'm just kidding.
Dominic,
dolly zooms. Dolly zooms are cool.
I mean, it's a great list, but you know, I totally agree that some of that stuff you're like, oh, okay, yeah, we get you're trying to be, but yeah, if it serves some purpose, there's nothing wrong doing it. The biggest problem I have with movies is when they do something stylistically just to be stylistic instead of it having some function that goes along with the movie or the style they're going for or whatever. You know, it's like that's out of place and just trying to be cool. You know,
the biggest lessons I think are the acting and the sound. Avoid that stuff.
And your casting.
If you want your movie to start with an alarm clock, do it.
Do it.
All right, guys, let's
move
on.
Make it the best alarm clock opening of all time. Just, there you go.
Yep. Well, all right, guys. Let's go on to Schmollywood. We'll see you there.
All right.
Okay, welcome to Schmollywood. This is the part of Indie MovieCast where we talk about what's going on in Hollywood, man. Over in Schmollywood, because Schmolly. Hollywood.
Okay.
So here's some news. About our buddy George Lucas. Okay, so George Lucas directing massive Red Tails reshoots. And so Red Tails is George Lucas's World War II Tuskegee Airmen movie about like the first African American air flight, whatever, in World War II. So anyway, it's a movie that he's producing with Rick McCallum, his Star Wars prequel producer.
Yeah, and he's been working on this for years. I mean, he's been talking about making this at least for years. So
yeah, so he is producing it now. They're actually making Red Tails after years of you know, putting it into production. He got someone else to direct it, right?
Mm-hmm. That's good.
Yeah, that's good. So George Lucas may have learned his lesson. So we got Anthony Hemingway to direct Red Tails, who is just like a TV director. He directed, I don't know. It looks like Law and Order and stuff. So anyway, he got this guy to direct the movie. And now that it's done, I guess George Lucas screened it, he hated it, and he is going to direct massive amount of reshoots himself.
Boom.
So my question to you guys is, has George Lucas completely lost his mind? How could they let this happen? How could George Lucas not know until after the movie was shot that it doesn't work for him?
Does it not work for him, or I mean, would it work for us if we saw it? I don't know. This is
gonna be one of those Superman 2 situations where there's two versions of the movie, and you know, one that could have been and one that is, and which one's better, right?
Which one's gonna be better? Yeah, this is hard to.
It's frustrating.
So George Lucas is now going to redirect and reshoot tons of Red Tails, which is probably gonna make the movie like crazy over budget. And honestly, it's George Lucas who we know is like ridiculously into himself and makes terrible movies in the past few years. And I mean, just look at that 70-minute Phantom Menace review if you don't believe how nuts George Lucas is. And so he's going to reshoot most of this movie, and it's probably going to make it suck. I mean, unless it makes it better, what do you guys think?
I don't think it's going to be any better.
It's so hard to say because I don't know what the footage looks like. I don't know what the movie looks like now, so I can't imagine what needs to be reshot. I mean,
yeah.
All I know is that George Lucas has been trying to work on this movie for years, right? And he probably had it in his head exactly how he wanted it and seen it up on the screen. It wasn't what he wanted. And so now he's just going back out there to redo it, which, you know, it's like, why didn't you just direct it yourself from the beginning? You know, I don't know. It's confusing.
Well, it's strange to me that he produced it, but it's like he saw the script. He probably saw the dailies. He may even been on set.
Right.
Why, after it's all done, does he want to reshoot it all? I mean,
there's always this thing, though, like, you can look at dailies and go, oh, that's great acting, they're doing, you know, they shot it really well, it's in focus and stuff, but some people say, well, we got to see what a cut looks like before they can, like, sign off on if it's going to be, if it works for them or not. Maybe he was just waiting to see a cut, you know?
Maybe, so. But George Lucas is also notorious for never finishing his films, you know, he keeps adding to them, the Star Wars ones particularly. So maybe he just, I don't know, came up with ideas later too. And I don't know, we have to just see how this movie turns out now. I'll have to admit, I'm more intrigued now than I ever was about it. So
yeah.
Maybe the Tuskegee Airmen take a journey with the water folk of Earth to the center of the world to save whatever.
With the Gungans?
Yeah, the Gungans, you know? That's what he's going to add.
Maybe, Dennis.
It'd be breathtaking.
Yes, so Red Tails, it's a approaching train wreck? I would say yes.
Stupid, ridiculous, or train
wreck?
Yeah.
I just want to be able
to see
a trailer first. I want to see the first shot, though. Like, if he does just release the film, at least on the DVD, they got to have both versions. I want to see.
He won't.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't count on it, Dennis, but I would like to, too. Kind of like the Richard Donner Superman that came out.
Yeah.
You know, because Richard Donner made half of Superman 2, and then he was fired, and they brought on another director, but who changed a lot of things. So now there's a Superman 2 cut using footage that Richard Donner, blah, 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 blah. You know about it probably. So yeah, but there's two versions of Superman 2. There's two versions of Exorcist, the prequel, because of the same situation. So yeah, there will be two versions of this movie. It's just a matter of
just how shitty does that director feel right now? Anthony Hemingway, said his name was?
Yeah, poor guy.
I mean, wouldn't that suck if you did this? Like, oh, George Lucas wants me to shoot his movie, and you do it, and he hates it, and you're like, crap!
Yeah.
I blew it. There goes my career.
Guess I can't do any more Star Wars movies.
Yeah, exactly. This is the guy who ruined Star Wars. Wonderful.
Still, man, I mean, that's a lot of pressure, I think. It'd be like,
I bet George Lucas and Rick McKellum are so intimidating. They're both like gigantically fat, and they're rich, and they're powerful. And I bet they just stand over people and like cast shadows on them.
I would feel like overwhelmed, you know. And then to actually shoot it, have it done, and then Lucas just going, "Oh, this is I'd be like, "What?"
I think George Lucas runs his sets like the Emperor.
Yeah.
Yeah. He took a page from Palpatine. How could he? Anyway, that's a pretty interesting story, I think. We'll just have to see how that turns out, but
yep. That's all you can do. Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
See how it turns out.
Yeah, but it's George Lucas's place in history is going to be very interesting because he went from the greatest filmmaker ever to like the biggest film saboteur in history.
Maybe. Yeah.
So we'll see how his history turns out.
His legacy.
Yeah.
His legacy is.
He will be definitely one of the more interesting ones to study, I think, in years to come.
Yep.
Another notable filmmaker out there is Quentin Tarantino, of course, and he recently rescued the New Beverly Theater, which is a small little indie house that plays grindhouse films that he's actually been running for years. He's been paying rent on it and keeping movies there playing. And so this movie, this theater wanted to close down. He ended up buying it just because he's rich and extremely rich. And he actually said, as long as I'm alive and I'm rich, the New Beverly will be there showing double features in 35mm.
Boom.
You know, so that may sound a little bit nutty, but I gotta say, if I was a powerful movie maker making tons of money, I could see myself doing these things too, because I love movie scene. And Jay, you and I have been actually talking recently about trying, you know, the possibility of getting our own theater someday, which would be so
cool.
And using it as Ultimatum's headquarters and doing premieres and using
showing indie movies and shooting there and et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
Yeah. And Dominic, you and I have talked many times of how we would always want a theater just to show like Raiders of the Lost Ark one night and you know, on film in the big screen. And so I think Quentin Tarantino is just kind of living that dream. This is the theater that he went to as a kid.
Kid, yeah.
And now it's his, and he's showing it. He's going to show movies on it for the rest of his life, he says. Unless he's poor.
Why not?
It brings a tear to my eye, man. It's great.
Because there's a lot of people who, you know, I mean, he grew up. I mean, he's a cinephile. Everybody knows how much he loves movies. Uh-huh. And there's a lot of people who aren't filmmakers like he is, but who love movies, period. And you know, to keep and it's probably a hard market to, like, you know, make a lot of money with, but that the fact that he's still making it available is pretty commendable. And you know,
yeah, and we were talking about before how movie theaters going to movies is getting expensive, so they're showing less indie movies. And we were, you know, so maybe, you know, maybe more people will take a page off of this and revamp these old theaters and show movies for less than $10. And yeah, maybe this indie thing will creep up and be another underground thing like it used to be, rather than playing in big theaters for big money like they do now.
Bring back the drive-in. Bring back the drive-in.
I always said that a drive-in would be cool, like, right? It would be really cool. Instead of putting, you know, one of those speakers in your window, if you had, like, a Bluetooth stereo.
Or that auxiliary jack, a little cable just comes in, plugs right in. Beautiful.
Yeah, and you could listen. Yeah, and you could listen to the movie with your car stereo. That would be cool.
But, well, I know when drive-in theaters were going away, they started playing it through a radio frequency, so you could turn your radio to a certain station and you could hear the movie.
Right.
And the drive-in, I think, is fun and as a novelty, but how could a drive-in really make money? I mean, because theaters really just make money off the concessions these days.
That was the drive-in was a thing. It, you know, in its time, it was moments. But
I mean, as far as a business thing, a drive-in, you can only play movies at night. You can only play movies in good weather, and then you have the situation of people bringing their own snacks because that's kind of how movie theaters make money. So I don't know if we'll ever see the drive-in how it used to be. I would hope that more novelty drive-ins start, like maybe Quentin Tarantino opens a drive-in that's not really focused on profits and more focused on
be like Hellride the drive.
What does that mean?
It's one of those ones that his company bought.
Cool.
Didn't we see like a poster or something like that when we went to go check out the we actually checked out a vacant drive-in while we were doing pre-production for a movie that we hadn't written yet. And wasn't there a poster or a sign that said Hellride showing tonight or something like that?
It was some weird 80s movie. Yeah, I forgot.
It's just
what
funny
it was.
You brought that up, Dennis.
It's a good movie. I like it.
There was like an actual sign.
Poster for Hellride at the abandoned drive-in theater here in Albuquerque.
Well, it wasn't a poster, but it was a sign written big like Hellride.
Yeah, someone like wrote it.
So and so.
Yeah, someone like wrote it in paint. It was funny. It was just sitting there in a bunch of trash. Yeah. Yeah. There's one drive-in theater in Albuquerque that just kind of sits there and it's awesome and it's just.
Now it's a big field. They pulled out all the you know, the post where the speaker was.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, so I guess comparing Quentin Tarantino to George Lucas, you know, one is a rich, eccentric filmmaker that is like really cool and is into the indie scene still and buys cool theaters. And one is an eccentric rich filmmaker who
went off the deep end.
Yeah, who doesn't even know how to make a movie anymore, it seems like. But he thinks he's better than everyone else. Yeah, I'm talking to you, George Lucas. Yeah, that's what people think of you. I know you're
come
listening.
On the show, please.
Yeah, I know you're listening.
Come on our podcast. Oh, we'd be so yeah, we saw if you he actually came on the podcast.
If George Lucas came on this podcast?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
So nerd. So nerd.
So nerd.
I don't even know what to say.
We're like, we love you. We hate you now. We hate
no,
you.
No,
so
no. I would. George Lucas, if you come on this show. George Lucas, if you come on our show, we're going to ask you the hard questions. You're going to.
What is this, like some
that's a
60
promise.
Minutes interview or what?
I challenge you, George Lucas. Coming soon on Indie Movie Cast. You heard it here first. Okay, so moving on. Let's talk about a couple trailers, guys. The first is the Red Band trailer for Kick-Ass.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that looks. I think it looks like it's gonna kick ass.
I want to be in this movie.
Yeah, I wish I made this movie.
I know. Do you know what I love about it? For some reason, I love kids cussing.
I know.
I want to make a movie where it's like kids, like a la Stand By Me or whatever, cuss.
Why
I
is that?
I really do. I think it's so cool, and I think it's so like it's so true. I mean.
I know. Yeah. Kids
so
cuss more than
a fact of life.
Yeah. Your kid cusses more than you, I guarantee it. So.
Yeah.
And that's why, like, I hate kids in movies generally. I hate seeing kids because they make them all smart. They make them act like adults. Like, I hate the kid in The Blind Side so much, I can't even tell you. But yeah.
The Blind Side or Sweeney
Boat. Make the kids cuss. Make the kids talk about sex and nasty things, and you got real kids, you know?
Yeah.
All right. Well, even E.T. I mean, those kids were real. They talked about real stuff and called each other
douchebag. Yeah, even though they weren't completely
and...
vulgar, they would say like words
no,
like
they,
that. Yeah.
They didn't say douchebag. They said penis breath.
Oh, penis breath. Yeah.
I remember that shocked me as a kid. What?
But I just love like kids cussing. It's so cool.
Well, anyway, lots of kids cuss and kick ass. I, you know. And Jay, this must be your dream movie because your boyfriend's in it.
Nick Cage, dude. Yep, it is my dream movie.
Yeah, so
every once in a while he comes out with a jewel. So
this may be now my most anticipated movie of the year. I'm so excited for it.
Me too.
Yeah, it's gonna be awesome.
Yeah, so you guys haven't seen it yet, look up the Red Band trailer, the one where they cuss. Dominic, what do you think? Are you psyched?
Oh yeah, I am. Really psyched. I just hope that the trailer hasn't shown all the good parts. I hope there's a lot more to it. But
it seems like
it's gonna be fun. So yeah, I'm excited.
Yeah, this looks like one of those movies like why didn't I think of that? Yeah.
It's gonna be violent.
Well, and you know, and that whole 48-hour thing, like the one of them's always now superhero genre.
Yeah.
And it's like exactly what people should be doing instead of like trying to make something
a Marvel movie. I figure if I got superhero movie after Kick-Ass, I'll have trouble trying to think of something funny. But the next trailer I want to talk about is one called Waking Sleeping Beauty. And I just thought this was really interesting. This movie is it's a documentary about the days of Disney in the 80s and early 90s, basically.
Disney finally picked up the ball.
Well, Disney hit a low. I mean, we've talked about Disney a lot when BSJ was on the show and we saw Princess and the Frog. And so this movie's about Disney in the 80s when they made Black Cauldron and these movies that were pretty big flops and how they turned themselves into the biggest movie animation studio ever with Little Mermaid. And it shows people in the past like John Lasseter. Was it John Lasseter?
Well, they show Jeffrey Katzenberg in one shot saying.
Yeah,
like,
Jeffrey Katzenberg, and they show Tim Burton and all these people that worked at Disney in those days. Really old footage from the 80s on bad VHS video cameras.
Yeah, it looks crazy, though.
Yeah, but it just looks so interesting.
They were saying there was a little snippet in there, like, you know, they put out a movie, I don't know which one it was, Disney did, and it was beat out by the Care Bears movie, and they're like, oh my goodness.
Yeah, I think it was the Black Cauldron.
The Black Cauldron, they just couldn't, so. They're like, okay, we gotta fix this, you know.
So. Yeah. Yeah, Dennis, are you down for Waking Sleeping Beauty? It seems
I am. Right. It's got Tim Burton in there. I can't wait.
Yeah, it's rare that a documentary seems so appealing in a trailer form, but this one is really interesting to me, especially because I was a child through this. When I was a kid, guys, I was so into Disney movies. I wanted to be an animator. I loved
it. I did too. I wanted to do animation.
Yeah, it's
not like Disney made bad movies anyway. They made, for the most part, pretty good movies.
Well, there's definitely these different styles that they go through, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they hit, like, yeah, The Little Mermaid to... I guess it goes all the way up to Lion King. It's just a totally different take.
Well, Disney died in the early 70s or late 60s. Like, Jungle Book, I believe, was the last one that Walt Disney was involved with.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of went downhill from there until, like, the early 80s when they were just, you know, not classics by any means. And then this is the movie about how these people turned it into the Disney we know today, basically, yeah.
I think it's going to be, I mean, I'm hoping it's really cool. From the trailer itself, it's just inspiring enough as it is, just because you look at everybody, like Tim Burns, this young kid.
Yeah.
You know, and everybody's just like, everybody is passionate about what they're doing and pushing to tell stories, and it's about the art instead of about making money, you know? And that's something very special.
And it turns into making money because quality ends up doing well, usually. And and I love how 80s it looks. It looks so 80s. It looks like my parents' home videos of when we were babies. I mean,
it looks crazy, like, yeah.
Yeah.
Those VHS cameras that they used back then. It looks like this whole movie was filmed on that. I'm so excited.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see those, what do you call them, polos with the elastic band.
Yeah, and those giant glasses.
Yeah. Oh, the glasses, the hair, everything. I can't wait. Oh. It's going to be good.
Yep, so... So that looks great. So I guess that's enough for Shmollywood. Not too much news this week. But we're going to do something interesting with Think How I Think, and we'll see you guys there. Okay, welcome to Think How I Think. This is the part of the show where we review movies. And we're doing it a little different way this week. We are actually going to go see the movie now, and then we're going to come back and review it. So the four of us are about to go see Shutter Island. And so I just want to let you know that we're going to go see it, and then we're going to immediately do the podcast. So you're going to get gut reactions.
Yeah. So I mean, we all feel like we have a certain sort of familiarity with this movie because we've seen the trailer like about 89 times.
Yeah. Really? I don't think I've seen it. What's this movie about?
The trailer.
If there's one good thing, it's that we don't have to see this trailer again
anymore.
God.
So yeah,
I can't wait. I'm excited, man.
Yeah, it's getting mixed reviews, but we'll see what we think right after this.
All right.
There.
Here we go.
Here we go. Whoa!
Abraham Lincoln!
Shutter Island. So far, it's kind of over the top and melodramatic.
That's pretty damn funny.
Okay, Think How I Think. We're back. We're in the future. We just sat through Shutter Island, the four of us, and we're getting our instant reactions. Let's just go around real quick. Jay, what are your reactions?
I hate it when you call me first.
Okay,
I liked it. No, I was just gonna say I really liked it. I enjoyed it. I liked the actors. I thought they were the actors were top notch. The directing was good. There's some continuity issues, but that's in every Scorsese picture. The look of it was very Scorsese. it might be a touch too long, but all said and done, I had a good time at the theater.
Well, I didn't, but I disagree with everything you said. I don't know, guys. I thought it was really boring. I thought that it was way too long. And I thought, well, we'll get into it more. Dominic, what did you think?
I really liked it, too. Like, for a little bit, I was like, okay, where are we going here? But then as it ended, I really liked what it did. So I don't want to give too much away for viewers that haven't listened.
Well, let's just spoil it up. You liked the, I mean, you didn't predict the ending. You didn't know that he was a mental patient the whole movie.
I'm stupid. Well, the thing is I liked how they made it completely the feeling of it. So by the end, when he is still trying to deal with the uncertainty of everybody around him and how he just doesn't trust them, it like hit it really good. It just like hit it home, like the whole idea of people who are schizophrenic and just don't trust anybody, and it's always like this cycle in their head that they can't get out of. And I just like the way that they created that world.
He's a schizophrenic. What makes you think he's a schizophrenic?
Well, just because he's so untrustworthy of his surroundings and who's on his side and who's not. And I just like that.
Well, they never said he was schizophrenic.
Well, I'm not. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is like that's the kind of feeling that I felt. Like by the end, you think he's come around, but yet he still is not there. And it's like it just brought that feeling perfectly for me. So I don't know. I just really had a good time. And I thought
I enjoyed it, but I knew that he was patient from the beginning.
You knew he was a patient.
I don't know. I just think, it was a little, not from the beginning, but I mean, like, you know, like I said, it started with the cigarette. He never had his first cigarette from the get-go, whatever. But it was too long. He could have made it a lot shorter and gotten the same feeling across. I liked how you're like on the journey with him. I liked that, but you knew the whole time. And
first dream sequence, when he had the first dream sequence at the beginning of the movie where he's talking to his dead wife, I was like, okay, well, he's a mental patient. You know, it was, maybe since I've seen Dr. Caligari about 10 million times in film school, but you know, it's like a pretty used up technique where you don't know he's a mental patient till the end. And yeah, so I just kind of sat through the movie just thinking, okay, well, he's a mental patient. This is all in his head, or some of it is. It's just a matter of what's in his head and what's not in the end, which still isn't clear by the end of it. But Jay, you were just riding along with it. You said you didn't pick up on that.
No, I thought it was. I agree with what I thought. Like all the elements of how he transferred. You know, the memories that actually happened to him to other people and how they merged all that together was really quite well done.
It was? I mean,
yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, he kills his wife after she kills their kids. He denies it. They never say he's a schizophrenic, but he denies it. He gets on hallucinogenic drugs in this island at some point. He has a recovery. They send him away, and then he goes back to being delusional. So they trick him into coming back, and they do this whole charade to try to cure him. I mean, that's how I picked up the story was, right, guys?
Mm-hmm.
So my questions are: was the storm was the crazy storm part of the plan? Was it in his head? It looked like there were branches breaking all over the place, and at the end of the movie, it's just green and pretty. The people are.
That's what I was wondering about the storm.
At the beginning, the people are ugly, and at the end, they're.
The storm was created by him.
The storm was.
It was all in his head.
So the whole storm was in his head. So he's just kind of wandering.
The beginning, it's beautiful. Yeah. Storm's in his head.
So the captain of the boat said there's a storm coming, and that was in his head. At the very
well, how did he get on the boat in the first place? They were just humoring him.
Well, I'm assuming they got him on a boat, humoring him to investigate the island.
Which, by the way, that opening scene looked really cheesy of them on the boat.
Oh, well, I was going to get into that. The whole movie was terrible green screen. Really bad. Like really bad. I don't know.
That's what I don't know. That whole opening part of them on the boat looked pretty bad to me.
And when he's like crawling down into the cave, it's like
all the rocky cliff stuff kind of looked like, oh, that's stuck in there.
Well, it was all just obvious green screen. There was such a bad scene of them driving with the guy not looking at the road. Everything I hate about green screen was in this movie, but I was going to bring that up later. But that's not why I don't like it. I don't like it because I thought this movie was going to be scary or exciting or thrilling or something, and it was none of that. I was bored.
It was a psychological thriller.
Were you thrilled? What was thrilling? Him hanging
psychologically, I was.
You were psychologically?
Yeah, I didn't know what to expect. I mean, the previews make it look like it's going to be a horror film for sure. And a
it
horror
would
film
have been awesome as a horror film.
And it could have been. I mean, why not? I mean, I didn't see it as a horror film. I saw it as a really obvious little twist they're just building up to. And I know this was a novel, and I'm already flipping through message boards, and people are, you know, saying that it didn't do the novel justice. It's
really?
Yeah, the novel is much better, blah, blah, blah. You know, stuff you hear when the movie's a little flaky. You hear people crying out that you should read the novel. Oh. Kind of like with Lovely Bones, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I wasn't feeling this movie, man. I was totally... I was just bored. I mean, I thought it was so obvious, and it was just a matter of what's real and what's not, and that wasn't even clear at the end. Now I'm repeating myself.
No, and I'll tell you, but Alex, did you not like the acting? Did you? Because I thought the acting by every actor was like pretty.
Like Mark Ruffalo? You think Mark Ruffalo's the worst actor?
No,
in the
I thought
world?
He was so good in it. I was like so surprised at how good he was in this. I was so into Mark Ruffalo. He was like probably my favorite character.
Are you serious?
Yeah. I thought he did such a great job. Seriously, I did.
I thought the acting was all right.
The only thing I can maybe complain about as far as the acting is like Leonardo DiCaprio pretty much had his eyebrows crossed and his forehead wrinkles.
Oh, that's just DiCaprio always.
But no, I totally. I was like, wow, this is pretty top notch acting. Ben Kingsley. Everybody, you know, and that whole scene, oh, that one scene was so crazy where they're shooting all the
people
Nazi
in the camp
surrenderers.
Yeah, that was a crazy shot. I'll admit that. That was a crazy shot.
It's insane.
Yeah, I don't know, Jay. I think I saw a different movie than you. I thought that
maybe. Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, I thought that the act wasn't impressive, but you know, it wasn't like it was abysmally bad. You know, you know, and then the other thing, it's like at the end of this movie, this is just a really virtuous, evil looking mental island where they're just helping people and it's all just elaborate plans to help people out.
That was definitely Ben Kingsley's point of view. Even from the beginning, he stated that like he, you know, has radical ideas of actually trying to sit and listen and talk to the patient, you know.
Which is why he was able to run around the island for 2 years or whatever it was.
Well, just that part.
That instant,
just those 2 days or whatever.
I guess. And I mean, I don't know. I don't know what the point of the blowing up the car was. I mean, there was just so many like fragmented scenes. Maybe I didn't get it. Maybe I don't know.
Well, I got that. But, I mean, that part of it, I thought like he was blowing up the car, and then they brought in like his, you know, the illusion of his wife, and that was him like saying, "I'm letting go of you." And they didn't really, you know, because that was the whole thing. It's like, you got to let go of your wife. She's gone, man. And then so when he was, you know, sticking the tie in there, I thought that was like a metaphor for that. But then they kind of, it wasn't too much. I don't know.
Well, it seemed like he was trying to distract the guards, but then it seems like they saw him and they were chasing him. But then they weren't chasing him, so I was thinking, oh, well, that's just because they're toying with him, because he's, which they were. But it all just took away all the suspense for me. Even that, like, exciting scene I thought wasn't exciting. I don't know, Dennis, go on with what you...
It just wasn't suspenseful. I just think the movie's an oxymoron, you know? Like, it just, they make statements, and it just keeps coming, you know, then they obliterate it, you know, later on. It just kind of... Like you were saying, Jay, with that metaphor, like I said the same thing, and she comes back, you know. And
right.
I don't know. It just, It seemed to set, and I didn't feel any suspense whatsoever, even when he's talking with the guy in the cell, who I like mm-hmm. that actor, by the way. I thought he was great. I can't remember his name. But that was like this, you know, there was nothing scary at all, nothing suspenseful. I didn't feel anything.
Yeah, they build up going into Ward C like it's going to be like a horror show. And then, yeah, they just kind of wander through there and talk to a couple crazy guys and leave.
Right, yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
Anticlimactic.
Yeah, I mean, I was just not impressed at all. I mean, I could kind of tell. I don't know. When you have a mental hospital, the second you introduced the delusions, the second they showed the wife, I was just, it just lost me. I just thought, well, you know, he's either crazy or they're trying to drive him crazy for some reason. But
they set it up like Bad Dreams, and then they set up like the whole thing, you know, like he's coming out of this kind of crazy anyway because of what he saw in World War II.
I thought it was funny how we were talking about dream sequences earlier, and half this movie is dream sequences. But yeah, I mean, yeah. They, I mean,
and over the headshots, but I like those.
Yeah, over the headshots and the eccentric mad scientist subplot or whatever. I don't know, all stuff we were talking about earlier. But Jay, so this movie had you. I mean, this movie is getting mixed reviews, you know, in public. So you know, I guess it's getting mixed.
I could kind of see that. Yeah, I don't know. I definitely enjoyed it. It was a good Scorsese film. It's not his best, of course not. It's not, you know, it's not a masterpiece. But you know, did I like it better than say Edge of Darkness? Yes. Wolfman? Yes. You know, did
you did you, you liked know. It better than Edge of Darkness? I don't know. Well, I guess I didn't like it. I don't know, man. I thought that it was weak. I thought that Scorsese, I thought it was mostly in the script, I guess. I just thought it was obvious. Maybe if I was going along with the movie, maybe if I was just kind of, if it did surprise me at the end, then maybe I'd be more along with it. But even then, I mean, what was with that drowning scene? Why was that so long?
What drowning scene?
With the kids drowning and him, you know, I mean, that wasn't that long.
Well, he was sad. Oh, at the end?
Yeah, wasn't everything drawn out and like okay, once
some of it was drawn out. I really like that sequence, but like a lot of the scenes were probably all like 2 to 5 minutes too long. But that's that's another thing that Scorsese's pictures are always like a good half hour too long.
Well, not always. I don't know. Maybe I don't know. I think there's certain things Scorsese is good at and certain things he might not be. And I think this movie was trying to be a thriller. And it just wasn't. I think it may have been written to be a thriller, and it was not made like that, maybe. I don't know. It just didn't have me.
It looked all right, except for, like I said, the green screen bothered me, and I was expecting more of a suspenseful movie.
It didn't look like a real island to me. It looked like they were shooting at some rich person's house for a while, and then the rest was green screen. You know, didn't even attempt to, like, find an island or anything. It might as well have been at Hogwarts.
And to be honest, I really tried to believe that he wasn't I didn't want to believe that he was like in the asylum itself, but it just was so easy to.
Well, I mean, the other option is that he's not crazy and they are messing with him and just trying to bring him in there to cover up whatever. But it seems like that's not believable because, I mean, I wasn't going for that because I was like, oh, well, they could have just captured him and brought him in at any time. Who cares if he's a marshal or whatever, you know, if he's trying to bring down the weird experimentation island. But I also didn't buy that it was just a completely virtuous island at the end.
And it wasn't. And it wasn't. They still went through with, you know,
the lobotomy.
Still gonna be lobotomized, you know, it wasn't virtuous. But see, the interesting thing is when you think about it, it's all kind of from Leo's perspective, his point of view. And you're kind of like, and if you just kind of take it in his kind of, if you go into that character's mind frame and how everything unfolds, I think there's a level of appreciation there where, you know, okay, like you can watch it now knowing, okay, yeah, he's crazy. But then just the evolution of it, I think, of him discovering he is at the end, is I thought that's kind of interesting how it was kind of played out that way.
Yeah, it may work as a book that way, you know, because when you read a book, you read it from a certain character's perspective. Who knows, maybe this one's even in first person or something. you know, so you're along with them so much. But in a movie, it's you're just in there predicting everything. I was.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, so maybe the book is good and it just doesn't translate well. You know, not all books can make good movies. And
I think books of this sort of nature, I'm only imagining, I obviously haven't read it, but of this kind of nature where there is like dream sequences and I don't know, everything that the movie tried to apply, it is harder to show that in a movie than it is a book, because you could use your own imagination of how it's supposed to look. I think it's easier to explain all that stuff that was supposed to go on in the movie in a book. I'm not making much sense here, I know, but
yeah, you are. I mean, I guess I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I guess my point is it's just not that good of a movie, as far as I think. You know, it could have been a lot better. I wasn't buying it. Dominic, you still there, Dominic? Hello?
I'm here.
You have anything else to add?
I like the conversation you guys have. JT's more on my side, so, like, he explained the stuff that I liked just as perfect, so.
Yeah,
and you don't shut
him. I'm very articulate. I was just looking for Scorsese's, refrigerator shot.
Where
was that at?
Yeah, I kind of feel bad about breaking some of those rules in voiceover until I see that Martin Scorsese goes against this list pretty. Yeah.
I didn't see any dolly zooms.
Yeah, pretty.
No, no dolly zooms.
You say, Jay, that the island wasn't virtuous, but at the end, tell me if I'm wrong. Everything's green. Everybody looks happier. Nobody's like crazy devil looking like when he gets on the island. And
well, everybody's kind of crazy devil looking because I think everybody's aware that he is a patient and that they're just kind of like, you know, they know he's a patient. And so everybody's kind of looking at him like, okay, just act natural, but I can't help but stare.
But it was all green. It was all pretty there. I mean, and the fact that.
Well, it looked like there was time elapsed. It looked like time elapsed. It looked like, okay, here's a rainy season. But then like 2 months down the road, it turned into summer. Remember how we were complaining that in Brothers, it was winter for, 365 days out of the year. Well, it looked like there was a time elapse here, and it was probably it looked springy.
Okay. Okay, so if it's springy and the storm wasn't in his head, and the ugly people weren't in his head, then why was the storm such a factor of him not leaving? Were they planning on a storm being there? I mean, when wouldn't he just leave the island right away, like when he was about to, until
right.
the storm didn't allow it? I mean, is that just a huge plot hole, or was the storm in his head? Because I kind of figure maybe this whole storm's in his head. I mean, and I guess that's the whole problem with this movie is that by the end of it, you don't even know what was real and what wasn't, what was a dream and what was real.
I think that's what's kind of cool about it. You know? I mean,
I think that's.
I agree. That might be what makes it good, but I mean, it doesn't leave me like Lost Highway did, where I don't know what that movie's still about.
But that's what I kind of thought though. I thought that it was trying to be. I mean, it seemed like kind of David Lynch-y. But mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't think there's much to interpret. I think it's just I guess my question is, was the storm in his head or not? I guess that's what I'm struggling with.
Was the storm in his head or not? Maybe that's the great mystery. Maybe that's up to the viewer. I don't know. I honestly don't know.
The cliffhanger. I'm kind of along the lines of it's in his head, but
in his head.
Dominic, what do you think?
You know, I think that I like that that you kind of it's kind of you don't know exactly if it's in his head or not. I think that sells the schizophrenia I was talking about later, even though we don't say schizophrenia. I think.
Well, I just read it in Wikipedia. They call him delusional. Delusional.
Okay.
Well, it blurs the lines between reality, what's reality and what's fake. That's what I liked about it. I think.
But Dominic, the schizophrenia thing. About the schizophrenia thing. So you're right. Schizophrenia is when you're paranoid about everyone else. Schizophrenia. I mean, I'm not an expert on schizophrenia, but I think that Leonardo DiCaprio was doing schizophrenic symptoms. The movie implied that the drugs were making him see visions, like they were hallucinogenic drugs.
Right, but wasn't that part of like his what he thought it was about? That's why he didn't trust anybody. Like he thought it was in the cigarettes and stuff. So was it like that? He just mistrusted everybody, and that was his reason.
reason for it, that he was being drugged. Like, people think that all the time, when, or at least in movies, that they're getting drugged by, you know, their doctors and stuff, when it's not the case. They're trying to help him.
So he was schizophrenic then? I mean, because if he's schizophrenic, he's schizophrenic. But it seemed like the movie was implying that he's just really traumatized from the war and really in denial about his wife. And he's just, I mean, I don't know. I'm not a doctor, but can you just, like, get schizophrenic from traumatic events?
Well, I think, so you're, I mean,
I think that's something
that's embedded in you from the beginning, right? Is that what you're saying,
yeah,
Alex?
Yeah, or, I think the movie was saying that he was just really traumatized, that he drove himself nuts. And, but as far as him making up whole new, I don't know. Maybe I'm just not up on my mental health, but I thought that they were kind of skipping around on what's wrong with him as well. Like, it was a, or were they deliberately keeping it vague? Because it's like, if he is making up stuff, how far does it go? Did he make up the storm? Did he make up the lady in the cave? Did he make up everything?
I think the only thing real was that little flashback of his wife and kids, and everything else was convoluted. Mm-hmm. And didn't they say they made up, they like played a charade on him, so he actually was on the boat and arrived at the island and all that? So
yeah, it's blurring the lines again.
I mean, did Ben Kingsley, his character, when he Leonardo DiCaprio finally meets him in the lighthouse or whatever at the end, did he ever mention the storm? I want to say that he did, but I can't remember.
No, the storm wasn't mentioned then, and that's the thing. But that's the thing. When did he snap out of it? Was it in the lighthouse? Was it when he was sitting on the steps with Mark Ruffalo at the very end? Was it all in his head at that point? I mean, it's not clear, and I don't know if it's purposely vague or not. But in the end, I don't know. I don't care.
I don't know. I think maybe that's why I liked it, is because the lines were blurred, and by the end, you're like, okay, so he is mentally insane, and then when he goes into that little cycle where he's like, I don't trust anybody here, and they look at each other like, this guy isn't cured like we thought he was, and then the cycle continues again. But I don't know, I like that you're basically as confused, knowing a little bit more than he does about his condition, but you're just with him, you know, he's just not right in the head, and you see why, and you understand that he's just going crazy, and there's nothing anybody can do.
Well, my thing, I liked what he said too, kind of at the end there, like you were saying. He what did he say? He said something like, do you want to live in hell or something, or die a good man?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that was kind
of, or monster or something like that. I don't know, monster. I don't know.
But is he a monster for killing his wife after she drowns his three kids? I mean, was he even, I don't know.
No, well, but I think that's his mental anguish.
The hell out of it.
That's his mental anguish, and that's why he's created this alternate identity and all this stuff, and that's why he wants to live in hell.
Yeah, he didn't want to believe that his wife murdered his kids, and he doesn't want to believe that he murdered his wife.
Mm-hmm. So. Okay, so that's right. So that's what I got too. So he didn't want to believe it. He created this thing in his head, and the whole time Ben Kingsley is just trying to make him see reality, right? Mm-hmm. So where did the delusions and the visions come in? Is it the
drugs?
That's
the psychosis. That's the mental part of it. That's
just what he did on his own.
Blurred. Yeah.
I don't know. Something on Yahoo Answers. You ever read Yahoo Answers?
Mm-hmm.
One person asked, I just saw the movie, two things come to mind. Why did Leo have a Band-Aid on his forehead for practically the entire movie? Which, I was like, oh yeah. And the second was the raging storm that happened in the movie, was that real? Because, or was it made up? Because at the very end, the place looks great, flowers, fresh cut grass, no signs of damage, like you were saying, Alex.
Right.
And then somebody wrote back, was like, the Band-Aid came from the fight that he had with the two, with another inmate's two weeks prior, so that's where I guess that Band-Aid came in, when, you know, he had it with that fight. And then also the storm was just that, a storm, and there is always calm after the storm, which I think is kind of a lame answer.
Well, that's just an answer from another Yahoo user.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. I mean, I mean, I mean, I was kind of predicting through this movie. I thought I was along with it, but then at the end, I was just confused about the storm, and I still don't know. Even talking to you guys, I don't know if the storm is real or not, and I don't know if we're not supposed to know, like you said, Dominic, or if it's just supposed to be blurry. But I think that maybe you're supposed to know whether that storm is real or not, and I think it was a real storm, which just makes the ending confusing to me, and it makes it confusing to me that that was their plan. For getting him to stay there was a storm would be there or something. I don't know, man. Or maybe there wasn't a storm. And if that's
what this shows is that this movie, you know, if you didn't enjoy it or what have you, it's at least good for one thing. It spawns a conversation as far as what's believable and what's not.
I guess.
You know what I mean? Like that, it's created some debate like that. But I don't know.
I don't know. Scorsese, you lost me this time. What can I say? I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. I mean, because I was kind of thinking, I was watching this, I was thinking, oh, this is so predictable. Oh, he won an Oscar, now he sucks. He's just like everyone else. But by the end of it, I was kind of on board, but I was just really confused. And I still am. I don't know. Well, let's wrap this up, guys. I think we're a little bit lost with Shutter Island. Maybe give us some feedback. Maybe tell me what you thought. Tell me if this... if this storm was real or not, please, somebody, just give me a definitive answer. Somebody who's read the book, preferably. And maybe we can continue this conversation later. But, guys, like we said, big move, big week for Ultimatum this week. I'm so excited for our premiere.
Yeah,
can't wait to see you guys there. Yeah, so we'll take lots of photos. We'll put them up online on our Facebook page so you can see the status of it. You can check out the trailer for VoiceOver at ultimatumpictures.com.
Ah.
Yay.
But anything else you guys want to add, or are we
Oh, I'm good. I'm trying to find out the storm situation.
Yeah, well, maybe we'll follow up next week on the storm sitch. I don't know.
Yeah.
But because this is, you know, like I said, when we usually review movies, we usually review them a couple days after we see them, so we have some time to check the message boards and reflect. But this is gut reactions. You guys walked out happy. I walked out unhappy. Dennis, you're a little bit unhappy.
I'm in the middle.
Yeah, we'll see how we feel about this a little bit later, I guess. But thanks very much for listening. Please visit indiemoviecast.com. We welcome comments, questions, and suggestions, so log on in and contribute. And I did see that one comment on there. Thank you, sir. Didn't get to read it on the air this time. Maybe we will. Remember, we don't only talk the talk. To see the movies we've made, log on to ultimatumpictures.com and become a fan on the Ultimatum Pictures Facebook page. Until next time, I'm Alex.
I'm Jay.
I'm Dominic.
I'm Dennis.
Dennis.
All right, Indie Movie Cast was put into the public domain in 2010 by Ultimatum Pictures.
Bye.